Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Douglas Rushkoff, a master user and master interpreter of the digital world, is here, and he wants you and your kids to be smarter than the corporations that are now trying to program our online choices. In fact, Rushkoff has written a book. He's written a dozen books on media and society and teaches at NYU in the New School. The new one is called Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. Hey, Doug, welcome back.
It's good to be here.
And I'm going to read the list. The 10 commands, not commandments, commands, are in this order. Do not always be on. Live in person. You may always choose none of the above. You are never completely right. One size does not fit all. Be yourself. Do not sell your friends. Tell the truth. Share, don't steal. And finally, program or be programmed. Some of them are basic ethics 101, I think, that go to any aspect of life. But let's go right to program or be programmed, the title of the book. And command number 10, is somebody trying to program us?
Well, someone's always trying to program you. It's whether you have are on any sort of equal footing. You know, I think about the great language inventions of the past. You know, we developed speech. You know, we didn't just learn how to listen, we learned how to talk. You know, we developed text. We didn't just learn how to read, we learned how to write. And now we develop computers and we seem content to be users but not to be programmers. And that to me means not actually using the machine and pretty much being at the mercy of those who understand the language, who understand how to program. You know, if you're not programming the machine, then someone or something is programming you.
So you want kids taught not just how to use computer programs like word processing or web surfing, whatever, but to write programs. Otherwise, we're just toys for Google and Apple to make money off?
Right, to some extent. You know, when I learned computers, I mean, this was back in the 70s, when you took a computer class in junior high school or high school, they taught you how to use the computer. It was this anything machine that you could model anything you wanted. You could create a word processor. You could make the machine do stuff. You know, now when you take a class in computers, in public school anyway, they teach you how to use one of the Microsoft Office programs. So you're not learning computers, you're learning software, and that's a very different thing.
You write in historical context that the Torah, the Old Testament, was in essence a code of ethics for dealing with the highly abstracted text-based society that was to characterize the new millennia. Is it in that vein that you offer these 10 commands as a guide for the digital-based society?
Right. I mean, in a sense, you know, in an ideal world, the Israelites would have become a literate people. That's when God says to Abraham, you will be a nation of priests. What he really means is that they'll be able to read and write. You know, it won't just be hieroglyphs, priestly writing. It'll be text so that people can gather together and write their laws, change their relationship to God and to the cosmos, turn really what had been pure obedience into a contract, which is what Torah is. You know, and I think they realized people weren't going to learn to read and write. They didn't. It took them a couple of thousand years. So instead, what they did get were some guiding principles to live in a world that was no longer going to be a bunch of Bedouins walking around with your own little tribe in the desert, but now you're going to have these big cities and civilizations and farming culture and all of the distancing effects of text. You know, and now that we're moving into a highly digital landscape, I think that even if we are not going to be the generation that learns how to program, and our kids aren't, maybe our grandchildren aren't, at least we can learn some of the biases of this medium so we get more predictable results with our technologies.
And also in historical context, you write about humanity's adaptation to new technologies over time, where just an elite few controlled the tools of each new medium, while the masses interact by using the tools of the previous technological development. For example, you say the rabbis read while the masses listened. Those who control the printing press wrote while the masses read. Today we write in the boxes provided us while the techno elite program. So there's a straight line from the Old Testament to Gutenberg to today.
Right. I mean, the ability on offer now is programming. And I know it sounds like, oh, programming, that's something we want to do here. We're going to outsource that to people in developing countries. It's like bricklaying. It's nauseating. But that's
that's the technical work. That's not the creative work. But that's not at all true.
Well, not to me anyway. I mean, the comparison people like to make, you know, and usually the kinds of calls I get when I'm, you know, I'm sort of at the end of the initial tour for this book. The people keep saying things like, well, you know, I know how to drive my car, but I don't know how to pop the hood and fix the engine. And my response to that is that we're not talking about the difference between a driver and an auto mechanic. We're talking about the difference between a driver and a passenger. You know, I'm not asking that people know how to take apart the computer and fix the power supply and recalibrate the screen. I'm asking that people at least consider that these environments are programmed, that they're not just pre-existing conditions. And, you know, it's funny, I was on this show, you know, about 15 years ago with a book called Playing the Future, where I was so optimistic and saying, don't worry, we don't understand this technology, but the kids will, the screenagers will. They're going to come up, and because they're digital natives, they'll see it in a way that we digital immigrants can't. Turns out I was really wrong. It turns out we old fogies who watched the internet come up have a much better sense of what environments are programmed and which ones aren't. You know, you ask a kid what Facebook is for, and he'll tell you, oh, Facebook is here to help me make friends. You know, and any of us know that, no, that's not actually what Facebook is for. Facebook is here to help companies figure out how to monetize kids' social relationships.
Doug Rushkoff, his new book, Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. And let me go to one of the software commands. I guess you'd call it a software command. Which is, do not always be on.
Right. I mean, it's funny. Each of these commands are really based on one of the biases of digital media. I was kind of following a McLuhan technique where you really look at the biases. You know, how is this medium or technology tilted one way or another? So it's sort of like, you know, no, guns don't kill people, but they're more biased towards killing than, say, pillows are. And so I looked at what are the biases of this media, and I determined that digital media is really biased towards asynchronous behavior. Digital media occurs outside time. It's always programs are a series of a sequence of steps. They don't really live in a clock. They just wait. And the early net interfaces, the kinds of conversations that I was involved in the 80s and early 90s, places like The Well, which was one of the early bulletin boards, the beauty of these conversations was that you had all day to respond. You downloaded the conversation, you read it, and then you thought for hours, even days, about what you were going to say. The net was a place where you could be smarter than you were in real life because you didn't have to be quick. Now we take these technologies and we put them on our bodies to ping and vibrate with every incoming email. We lose the power of email, which is an in-your-own-time medium, and turn it into an always-on medium like the phone.
Or Facebook, where if something goes by on your wall, you may not actually notice it by the time you get back to your own Facebook page.
Right, and which then creates the sense, oh, I've got to stay online so that I can keep up with everything. Now I need the Google Live, the Twitter feed, the this, the that, as if somehow you are going to catch up with the net, where really all that's happening in the real world is the net is trying to catch up with you. You know, so if you're trying to catch up with this technology that could never be in the now because the net isn't alive, it isn't in the present moment, then you end up really just chasing your tail. And with all of these symptoms people now have, you know, phantom vibration syndrome where they think their phone is vibrating on their thigh even though it's not even in the same room.
Do you like Twitter?
I like things about Twitter. I think Twitter is a really useful tool for a very particular thing. You know, a friend of mine named Gordon Gould, an old New York Silicon Alley type, we thought up something that we called UPOC in the early 90s, which really was a Twitter for cell phones, but it was people couldn't use that kind of thing yet. I didn't see it. I didn't believe something like that could become this widespread, but I think people are using this tool for everything rather than just great announcements of things that are actually happening rather than blow-by-blow accounts of their sort of minute-to-minute linear experience.
Although one of the things about Twitter, different from the Facebook problem I was just referencing about things going by and you can never necessarily see that they happened unless you are always on, is that you can index you know, your view on Twitter by the people you follow, and then look down on their tweets as far down as you want and decide what thing to respond to or retweet and start another conversation. So it's a very well-organized
service.
Yeah,
and it's, I mean, the beauty of Twitter is basically fluid, where, you know, Facebook is kind of static. Facebook sits there. I'm going to go to this person's Facebook page and see what's there and look at their wall. I mean, the wall is a very, even as a metaphor, it's a very static, it's kind of still, where Twitter is just this stream so that you can pop in different parts and see how things are connected. So as an experiment, as fun, as it's a great thing. As a way for a person to organize and experience their lives, I think that's, you know, that's where it might get tricky.
What do you think about Facebook's new email that apparently will give priority to people you already know? I guess it's supposed to be, contrary to part of the one of the downsides of Facebook itself, which is that the network of friends becomes so broad that people could be on there as your friends without you even kind of realizing it.
Yeah, or even knowing who they are.
Yeah.
It's funny. I mean, I've been wrong before, but not usually about this. I look at Facebook as a very temporary thing. I look at Facebook the way I looked at AOL. It's like AOL, I understand. People needed a wading pool. They needed a way of experiencing the net that wasn't quite the net, because the net seemed so overwhelming. But eventually, AOL became part of the internet. And then once that division was gone, it was like, well, why not just be online? And I feel like, you know, the more and more people that kind of become your friend on Facebook, eventually there's no line. It's just the net. You know, or a phone book or something.
It is the most used website today, I believe.
Right. I mean, and which then, if it's almost as if on the net, once everybody uses it, it's almost like it has no purpose anymore. You know, it's just there. You know, that ubiquity and utility in some sense can become a website's enemy.
Well, it's the infrastructure. It becomes the infrastructure,
right,
like the telephone, as opposed to the messages on the telephone.
Right, and except the telephone companies had a monopoly. You know, they had a way to be there. If you don't, I don't know that just the fact that everybody signed up to this, to me, it doesn't feel any stickier than all of the ones that went before, the AOL, the Friendsters, and Orkut, and LinkedIn, and everybody else.
We have about 30 seconds left. Let's do one more of your commands, which is do not sell your friends. How do you mean that? We sell our friends kind of inadvertently sometimes online, right?
Yeah, and sometimes we do it pretty directly. I mean, that's really where social networks like Facebook are going. You know, that in the end, it's like, well, look, you can participate in this madness too. You know, people are not upset about the loss of privacy on these networks. What they get upset about is the fact that their friendships are being monetized by companies they don't even know. And when you play a Facebook game, one of these new Zynga games, you know, Mafia Wars and all, really the temptation there is, oh, you mean I can just give them my address book? You know, that's your value, are your social connections and your willingness to parlay them into other things is I think a potential downfall for
Douglas Rushkoff. His new book is Program or Be Programmed: 10 Commands for a Digital Age. Is this available in all the normal places?
Only some. It's actually mainly available through orbooks.com because we're trying to cut out the middleman in a net-friendly way.
Orbooks.com.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Douglas Rushkoff, thank you very much.
Thank you.